many times I've let you down. Hi, I'm John Byrne, executive editor of Business Week. Welcome to our 100th edition of Behind This Week's Cover Story, our podcast series that gets inside the making of this issue's major story. And you just heard that classic gem from Peter, Paul, and Mary, leaving on a jet plane. Well, maybe not. So how was your summer? If it was like mine, you spent a lot of time in airports. I remember going to JFK for a flight that had been diverted to Syracuse, arrived hours later than planned at 2:30 in the morning. Maybe you were waiting for a plane as well, or maybe you were on the tarmac waiting for a gate. You might have felt lucky just to get some peanuts and arrive home in one piece. I don't have to tell you, things are getting worse. Delays are up, and the risks are greater. Everybody seems to have a story about the headaches. And the cost of productivity? It's estimated at billions each year. But if you think the summer from hell is over, fasten your seatbelts, podmates. Another billion passengers a year will crowd into airports and planes within the next 8 years, and this year's Labor Day crunch could become an everyday flying fiasco. The world's largest and busiest air traffic system is stretched beyond capacity at its breaking point, according to the head of the Federal Aviation Administration. So why is it that the nation that leads the globe in commerce and innovation, that can put a moon on the moon 35 years ago, can't fly us from Atlanta to Charlotte, North Carolina, with at least a two-hour delay? You might have a number of guesses about that. Maybe extra layers of security after 9/11, but no, you'd be wrong. Or how about technology? Do we really have a better way for planes to fly more efficiently? Something a little more automated than controllers talking into radios and radar like they did during the Second World War? Turns out we have plenty of technology too, but it's been waiting for takeoff for years. Okay, then what about money? Is it just too expensive to fix things? Another infrastructure monster like bridges that we can't get off our backs. No, it turns out, in fact, we can afford it. So what's the problem, and why is it going to take a long time to straighten things out? The answer may surprise you. We'll tell you in our latest cover story, Fear and Loathing at the Airport. And we have on our podcast today the co-author of our cover story, Keith Epstein, who worked with Chris Palmieri on this. Keith, welcome.
Good to be here, John.
So, you know, we're used to thinking we can't do something because innovation hasn't caught up with the need, or because perhaps there's not enough money to pay for things. What's really going on here?
The trouble is one of the oldest in the book of human endeavor. Some of our listeners might even recognize this syndrome. You might call it fundamental organizational failure. Nobody seems able or willing to take charge. Various players in the system, whether it's the big airlines, the small aircraft owners, the controllers' unions, politicians, manufacturers of jets and jet equipment, and executives with their corporate jets, they're all locked in a kind of dysfunctional paralysis. The Federal Aviation Administration, meanwhile, just can't seem to do much about bringing all these parties together and committing everyone and the country to a long-term flight plan.
Now, this is a downside of deregulation, is it not?
Well, some people want to point the finger at deregulation, and in some ways, there are things the FAA can't do now that it used to be able to do. It had all kinds of control over the scheduling of flights and telling airlines what they could charge and where they would go and so forth. And so some people obviously would point to deregulation as part of the problem, in the sense that now an airline can schedule as many flights as it wants at any time. You know, John, when you were trying to go wherever you were going and ended up late in Syracuse, there may have been a whole cascading series of events that began with the simple fact that in a certain hour, there were more flights scheduled to take off and land than JFK could accommodate.
Which is typical at almost every airport, because everyone wants to fly out in the morning. So the airlines basically overschedule their flights. And so there are more flights scheduled to take off in the morning from most major airports, at least, than can humanly take off, right?
That's right. And that in a way, I mean, that's a fundamental business, isn't it? I mean, that's customer service. You do what the customer wants. If the customer, I mean, that's an irony saying it's customer service, of course, when you're sitting at the airport. And
I would say satisfying the customer is what you want.
Right. Satisfy, or at least at the point where the customer is making a decision whether to select your product, offering something that customer wants. And what the customer wants is a flight between at that crunch time in the evening after work or on a Friday, or the period between 8 and 9 at JFK is a big period.
So can the FAA even attempt to solve this?
Well, a long line of administrators at the FAA, and that's what the nation's top aviation cop, as it were, is called, an administrator. You know, a long line of these people have tried over decades and different administrations, Democrat, Republican, what have you, to try to avoid this crunch that everyone has seen coming. It became, you might remember, John, it was a big thing before the terrorist attacks of September 2001. People were talking about a passenger's bill of rights then, a need for reform. And then, of course, the attacks came, and that diverted attention from this fundamental other flaw with the air traffic system. But, you know, for decades, people have recognized this crunch coming and this problem ahead. It's almost like I would say it's a like watching a train about to wreck, that cliche, except we're talking about planes. And this, you have this explosion in flights and an outdated system that is incapable of keeping up with it. I talked with a former inspector general of the Transportation Department. He's been around for years. And he told me he feels like he's watching Groundhog Day, you know, that movie with Bill Murray, where Bill Murray has to go through the same day after day. He trips. He, you know, takes him a few days to learn not to trip in the same spot. Same stuff keeps getting said and fought about over and over. The same Band-Aids get put in place. Once before there was a technological fix everybody talked about, they're doing that again now. And to some extent, it looks like the government has learned not to trip in the same place, but it is still the same laborious process And the FAA is really not as powerful as you might think, and the FAA administrator is far from being an aviation air traffic czar, if you will.
And, you know, it sounds just like Washington. Nothing ever happens.
John, I know you'd like to point that out, that not much ever gets done in Washington, and sadly, this is an example. Some people blame the current administrator. His name is Marion Blakey, who made a couple of mistakes along the way, clearly. She inflamed the business jet and general aviation community at one stage by siding with the airlines and saying that she wanted a new way to raise money to pay for a new air traffic control system, and that new way would involve collecting user fees from those other users who right now are getting by without paying as much overall as the airlines.
And I'm sure that went down real well.
Oh, it was like lighting a match in a airport fuel dump. I mean, you've never seen such acrimony and lobbying and warring, you know, wars of TV ads. Some of our listeners may this summer have noticed some of those ads playing on CNN, the airport news programs over the summer. And some of those ads were placed by the airline industry. Some of those ads were placed by the business jet community. And some of those ads were placed by a new alliance the business jet community got and the general aviation community got together. That included even interest groups like corn growers, because corn growers are convinced that adding these kinds of fees to flights in rural areas can hurt their economy. So this thing mushroomed into this big classic Washington battle that really diverted attention and prolonged the time of a fix.
Now, you spend a little time with her, and she's leaving on September 13th on a jet plane, perhaps. What's she like?
One of the first things that struck me about her, she's from Mississippi, grew up in a small town, has southern charm. She has a lot of friends in a lot of places in journalism, in Washington, not necessarily at the White House and not necessarily throughout the aviation industry, but because she comes from a background where first as a communications consultant and then later as a government official, she was very focused on safety above other things. I mean, she helped Chrysler develop and market and get into this whole plan of selling airbags as a marketing tool that, you know, that people would actually be more willing to buy a product if it had safety equipment such as airbags attached. And then she was at the National Transportation Safety Board, and many of our listeners probably remember seeing her reassuring comments and so forth in the investigation of 9/11. So she came to the FAA with this kind of orientation and thinking she could sell safety. And she talks of times where talking to people, analysts in Wall Street, that sort of thing, who said, look, it doesn't work the same way at the FAA and in aviation as it does with Chrysler. You can't sell safety as a way to enlist support for the money you need to fix the system. She says that was a big shock to her.
And so she's been in the job 5 years, and she's leaving in September, and everything is worse. There are more delays, more planes are overbooked, more flights are canceled, and more baggage has been lost. And in fact, it's probably less safe now to travel than it was 5 years ago when she joined the FAA, right?
Yeah, even she acknowledges that no FAA administrator, you know, ever probably in the history of the organization has ever wanted to say anything but that air travel is the safest form of transportation out there. And certainly the statistics bear that out. No one's questioning that. But the risks are getting greater. There are, you know, airlines are coming close to each other on runways more often. There are near misses in the skies. Mostly, though, everybody's worried about what could happen. She herself speaks about that, you know, it's a very real possibility. Someday, something catastrophic will happen if we don't make sure that the system is running in a way that controllers and pilots know, have up-to-the-minute information about where they are, where the others are, to keep this tremendous flow going. I mean, one of the things that's been amazing to me in reporting this story is just the sheer volume of aircraft out there. I mean, we all sort of know it intuitively. Any of us, such as yourself, who endured a, you know, horror story this summer, has a sense that there's something going on here. But, I mean, the controller told me the other day, only a couple of weeks ago, and we're talking in towards the end of August, around Labor Day. But a couple of weeks before Labor Day, he's telling me about an evening when the backup at JFK, the airport you used, was 4.5 miles long. Backup wait of planes waiting to take off. This took up an entire runway. So that meant JFK couldn't use that runway for takeoffs and landings.
Wow. Now, obviously, as your story gets into this, technology is one answer. Let's talk a little bit about this whole next-gen idea and how that would help to sort of solve some of the congestion, at least.
Well, first, let's talk about the system as it is now, because there's some rather surprising things there, I think, that a lot of people may not realize. Some of what's in use now might have a better fit at the Smithsonian than in our system. And we're talking about, you know, pilots right now, when they fly these predetermined routes that are basically almost zigzagging at times, that are based on points in the sky they have to go through. They're really basically highways up there. It's, you know, most people think of, you know, the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, but not if you're a plane. The shortest distance is connecting all these dots. That used to be, in many cases, the locations of bonfires and these big, at the time, bright beacon lamps that were used in the very early days of aviation to guide airmail pilots. You know, we're talking about these guys who would fly by the seat of their pants, and they'd have to look through the clouds or whatever and try to spot those lights on the ground. And as far as digitization, there is a computer system that links the whole air traffic control system together, but the programming, the language, is called Jovial, J-O-V-I-A-L.
Lovely.
So old that there are only 6 programmers in the entire country who know how to write it. So what's the new system like? My colleague Adam Aston, in our issue, has sort of put together a description of the new system. And in effect, what it does is it's designed to give a picture to pilots and controllers of where planes are almost to the second, which is a lot different than the radars they use now, which might refresh 3, 6 every 12 seconds. And when a jet plane that's traveling at 600 miles an hour, that's a lot can happen in a second. So that's critical. It also uses GPS navigation, the same thing that some of our listeners no doubt have in their cars, guiding them from place to place.
Right.
The controllers don't have things, you know, as refined and precise and immediate as that. Some companies like UPS and FedEx have equipped some of their fleet with some of these kinds of things. So it's out there now. So with this kind of what they call in the aviation field situation awareness, the gap that you can have between each plane shrinks. So instead of maybe 5 miles, it could be 2.5 miles.
Now, Keith, I'm not being a naysayer on the technology, but I will say that I feel more comfortable at 5 miles than I would at 2.5 miles separation, regardless of what the technology is. Am I wrong-headed about that?
Well, there's something to be said for safe following distance, and different people might define it in a different way.
So you're telling me that technology would provide safe tailgating for airplanes. That's what you're telling me.
That's right. I think, and if you're talking about a system that can handle the kind of traffic that's expected, I mean, we're talking another billion passengers within 8 years.
Now, what are the pilots and controllers saying? What are they talking to you?
Well, that's interesting because it hasn't quite reached the point of road rage. But there is actually, you know, you think of this, the stereotypical notion of what the communication's like is these, you know, these guys with kind of maybe a Texas drawl, and they're very calm and restrained, business only, you know, giving out, you know, numbers and letters pertaining to runways. And anybody who's listened on a flight to the communications knows that, there doesn't seem to be a lot of emotion there. Well, apparently what's happening lately is there's a lot of emotion there. I was told by a controller of an incident very recently. At JFK, in which a pilot who was waiting for takeoff and in a long line said, you know, hey, you guys in the tower, are we going to take off anytime soon? And the guy in the tower responded, and he told me he responded this way and lost his cool. He said, you know, you're going to take off when we tell you to. If you have a problem with that, talk to the FAA, talk to your congressman, call a cop if you want. I mean, it got very testy.
Of course, everyone is to blame, right? I mean, the customers want the cheapest fares possible. They want to leave early in the morning when all these flights can't possibly take off. Weather is something that no one can control for, to be honest about. There are mechanical failures that really you can't control for either. The pilots have their own union issues. The airlines have been one big unprofitable mess for decades. You have a government that can't take accountability for what's going on in the air. So I think the finger of blame can be pointed in many different directions here, right?
It's like you have a jumbo jet full of pilots, and they're all in the cockpit, and there's not one of them who's really empowered to take charge, tell the others where they ought to sit, and fly the craft on a flight plan that everybody can commit to for enough years to get the job done.
And I'm actually afraid to suggest what it will take to change, because I think you and I both know what it will take. It will take a human disaster, unfortunately.
I've been working in Washington for, I don't know, 20-something years, and some of it has been spent actually covering aviation safety and stories such as that. And years ago, people were talking about the FAA in particular as an agency that was, they called it the tombstone agency. And people still talk like that. Everybody kind of...
Why the tombstone agency?
The tombstone agency because very often throughout its history, it has taken, you know, a tragedy, a major catastrophe to bring about remedies, to fix problems that were known to be out there and of concern for years and years. The National Transportation Safety Board, which is... where the current FAA administrator, Marion Blakey, used to be. Its business is to investigate airline crashes and then make recommendations for how to fix things that were the contributing causes of those crashes or might be causes of future crashes. And those recommendations sometimes often get clogged in the bureaucratic system and run into problems on Capitol Hill or with the industry or with some interest group. In other words, like so many things in human endeavor, sometimes, sadly, it takes a crisis or a catastrophe for people to come together and muster the wherewithal and maybe guts sometimes to achieve the change.
So, Keith, can you offer any advice to someone who's flying today? You know, there are many of these problems are completely unavoidable, but if you're trying to at least play the odds to allow you to take off and leave on time, how do you play the odds?
Well, my biggest piece of practical advice would be to, when booking a flight, don't just choose the fare that works or the time that is ideal for you. Go to, I mean, our own website, I believe, will have a link to sites that give you a sense of which flights have a habit of being delayed. I mean, there's a lot of data out there that you can get your hands on in a fairly effortless way that can tell you, okay, if you're interested in this in flight 206, leaving at 6:20, how often that flight has been an hour late? I mean, for instance, we were in our package for this issue, we were able to identify the most delayed flight in all of America.
So, what was the flight that was delayed
Let's
the
see,
most?
Should I be specific?
Sure, please.
The worst flight Atlantic Southeast flight 4104 from Atlanta to Charlotte. It's generally supposed to take off at 7:38 in the evening. And in June, it didn't take off on time even once.
Not once.
Average delay, 2 hours and 33 minutes.
You could drive there in less time.
Yeah, it would take about 20 minutes longer to drive, and you wouldn't have to go through security. I pity the poor person, and there must be somebody like this who must actually, for whatever reasons related to business or personal life, have to take that flight regularly.
Yikes. Keith, thank you for a great story. Thank you for participating in our 100th podcast. And I hope that you don't have to leave on a jet plane anytime soon.
Actually, I do, and I'm late. Thank you, John.
Take care.
I'm leaving on a jet plane. I don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go. There's so many times I've let you down. So many times I've...